Waiting on a tax return? Hopefully it ends up in your hands. Fraudulent tax returns due to identity theft increased by 30% in 2023. If you're in a bind this tax season, LifeLock can help. Our U.S.-based restoration specialists are experts dedicated to helping solve your identity theft issues. And all LifeLock plans are backed by the $1 Million Protection Package. So we'll reimburse you up to the limits of your plan if you lose money due to identity theft. Help protect your information this tax season with LifeLock. Save up to 25% your first year at LifeLock.com/aware.
To the Latin American History Podcast, episode 52, When Latins Fight, a conversation with Walter Milano. This is the second part of my interview with Walter. The first part was on coronavirus and the effect it's having on Latin America's economy. So if you haven't listened to that, I recommend going back and checking it out. Today we're back to the history. We're discussing his book, When Latins Fight, Why There's No United States of South America. The book provides an account of all the major wars that took place between states in post-independence South America. Doing this allows Walter to not just cover the stories of each conflict, but to pull out some of the common themes which run through them. In this episode, he explains how some of these wars came about, what their legacies are, and how the rivalries that they created affect the future prospects of the region. So, here it is. Well, thanks for joining us again, Walter, for coming back to talk about your book, When Latins Fight.
Thanks, Max.
I think this book is fascinating. It's a really ambitious project to take on so many big conflicts and to draw together the common themes within them, which I think the book does really, really well. At the beginning, you explained that Spanish America wasn't designed to be a unified place, that the way it had been set up as an empire worked against unification and encouraged conflicts almost. So I was wondering if you could elaborate a bit on why that was the case.
The thing about Latin America and the Spanish were there to really look for precious metals. That was their main intent, which was a very different intent from what the English were trying to do in North America. What they were trying to do is basically move troublesome populations out of England into other areas, into colonies, the different Protestant sects or Catholics and that kind of thing. And it was kind of to reduce the amount of political tension that was in England, especially following the civil wars. With the Spanish, after Spain had been successful in unifying itself and purging the Moorish influence, especially the fall of Granada, what they wanted to do is to gain a similar standing in Europe to the other major European powers, i.e., especially France and Britain. And so the key to power back there at the end of the medieval age was trade with Asia. And that was something that had been locked up, especially by the Italian states and by the Portuguese. And what they wanted to do was find another way to do it. And that's where Christopher Columbus came in with his proposal, a proposal which had been, flatly rejected by many different monarchies around Europe because they knew what the circumference of the planet had been. They had already known it for thousands of years. And they just saw that he would run out of all of his resources, water and food, before he would get there. The thing is that he ran into this landmass that nobody knew existed, which was the Americas, and they eventually found that the Americas had one, resource that they weren't even expecting to bring back from China, and that was, gold and silver, especially silver. Silver was the main, thing that they were after. It wasn't really gold, in fact. People have known for thousands of years that there's much more silver on the planet than gold. I think the ratio is 13 to 1. But the thing is that the Chinese had used silver or were using silver as their medium of exchange. And so therefore they would gladly take all the silver and then give them in return what the Europeans wanted. You know, spices, they wanted porcelain, they wanted all the different they wanted silk, all the different manufactured products that the Chinese were known for at the time. And so as the Spanish moved off the islands, as you detail very well, and then start going on to the mainland into Mexico, they find huge amounts of deposits of precious metal. And then they start hearing tales of other locations as well. And if you look at it, the organization of the colonies was really based on precious metal. In fact, Mexico is the first viceroyalty, okay, viceroyalty meaning that you are the direct representative of the royal, okay, so you're the vice, like a vice president. And so what they really cared about was, you know, the silver that was being produced, especially in the highlands and the northern highlands of Mexico. The second viceroyalty that's established is after Pizarro, finds the Inca Empire down in Peru and finds huge treasure troves of silver down there, especially in what today is known as Bolivia, and especially later on when they find the Mount of Potosi. So that's the second organization that is done. And so again, it's all done, the organization of these colonies is to make the silver industry work, okay? What I mean by that is they established the ports to, you know, move the silver out. They established the manpower, the so-called mita, you know, the form of, you know, slavery of indigenous people in order to work these mines, which had very low life expectancy. The third viceroyalty that then is established on the Spanish side is Nueva Granada, which today is Ecuador, Colombia, and Venezuela, because gold is, this time it's gold that is discovered out in the northern parts of Colombia and in parts of Venezuela as well. In fact, if you notice that in the news, there's still a lot of talk about the gold that Venezuela has at the central, at the Bank of England, and, you know, whether they can get it back or not and that kind of stuff. Most of this gold was actually mined early on, and maybe not necessarily in the colonial areas, but throughout time, because Venezuela actually sits on a big oil, I'm sorry, on a big gold deposit. It's been eclipsed because of the immense amount of oil that they have, but there's this huge complex in the southern part, in the Guyana's part, called CVG, that is there to mine the gold. And so royalty or the monarchy in Spain decided to establish a new viceroyalty, Nueva Granada, in order to lead to the production of that gold. So they would bring in slaves. They would then build, you know, huge fortresses. The fortress in Cartagena was there to, you know, protect the gold from pirate attacks at a huge cost. It almost bankrupted the Spanish Empire in building the stronghold in Cartagena, in order to then to amass the gold, you know, store it, and then get enough then to get the gold ships, the armada that would then sail back to Europe, sail back to Seville during the sailing season. And so as a result, then there's areas of Latin America that are completely ignored. Before I go into that, the Brazilians did the same thing. Brazil was really largely organized in order to develop the gold, especially that you had in the kind of central south area, what today is called Minas Gerais, which means general mines. There's a town called, which back in the colonial days, it was called Villa Rica, rich city, which today is known as Oro Preto, black gold. And so this was what was really driving the whole, you know, Portuguese empire to develop Brazil. In fact, the famous Bandeirantes, which are the slave hunters, for lack of a better word, which the Brazilians kind of, you know, glorified, what they were these bands of explorers that would go into the hinterlands, really hunting down Guarani, which were, you know, this indigenous tribe that today is, like, a lot of it is in southern Brazil, a lot of them are in Paraguay, and some of them in northern Argentina, and then bring them back to work in these gold mines. And again, that's why, if you notice, the southern part of Brazil is the one that's kind of most organized. It's the one with the most states, because again, the colonial organization was based around that type of extraction of precious resources. It was not colonization as in the British form in North America, which had its own problems as well. It wasn't like an enlightened form of colonization. given the fact that they were bringing in immigrations of people to basically get them out of Europe, and so there wouldn't be trouble anymore for the British Crown. Then what they did is they ended up then displacing the population. It was genocide. And so what they would do is this: they would push in further and further in. They would just displace the indigenous populations, making them move further west, and in the process also killing them off with disease and with war and that kind of thing as well. So it was different forms of subjugation. But with the Spanish, they needed to preserve the local population. They didn't want to kill off the local population, because the local population was the labor force. It was the manpower that was needed to work these mines, which were very risky, you know, operations. A lot of them were underground. A lot of them were under the worst type of conditions. Mining today in the 21st century is a dark and dangerous business. Imagine what it was in the 16th century or the 17th century. The life expectancy of a miner was counted sometimes in weeks or months, and that's why they were always in the constant lookout for more workers. And so as a result, then areas of Latin America are completely ignored. Areas that did not have any natural resource, or the natural resources which the Spanish were looking for, which was precious metals. And those are, for example, Chile. Chile was just kind of a backwater. The biggest backwater was Argentina, what we today call Argentina. And it really just came into being more as a backwater route to bring in contraband to the miners of Alto Peru, or the miners of Potosí.
You also point out in the book that most of the wars you cover, and you cover pretty much all of them, the main ones, were instigated in part by foreign interests. Sometimes there was a mercenary presence of foreigners, but often it was commercial interests from outside helping lead the Latin American countries on the path towards war with each other. I was just wondering if you thought that some of the conflicts could have been resolved by other means if it wasn't for this outside influence.
Ooh, that's a good question. You know, the thing that when you sit down and you think about it, both North America and South America are born out of the Industrial Revolution. It's the Industrial Revolution that really leads to the creation of the Americas as an independent political unit. Industrial Revolution, as you know, starts in the early 1700s with the advent of the first steam engine. And then later on in the 1700s, they started applying the technology to different kind of things, like, you know, weaving and looms and crushing things and movement. And so as the Industrial Revolution begins to take off, the need for the inputs for these industries begins to grow. In other words, the need for commodities begins to grow, and commodities in order to mass, you know, produce for the populations, because now you want to take care of these populations. You can sell, you know, processed food to these populations. You need, for example, cotton in order to put it into these looms and weavers and that kind of stuff. You need oil to lubricate the machinery. You need rubber to insulate the discovery of electricity and the wires that are coming out. You need rubber to insulate it, because otherwise to just short out or kill the people who are handling this stuff. You need saltpeter, you need nitrates in order to basically run the gunpowder that is now massively needed on this, you know, industrial war machines that are being created. I mean, World War I is really the civil war in the United States, and also, you know, other European conflicts show the industrial impact on warfare, that you can now have, you know, cannons, and you can have mass-produced, you know, armament and that kind of thing. And Latin America at that time is kind of the sole source of a lot of this of these commodities, and they're placed. They happen to be located, many of them, in kind of intersection areas. And that's the thing, is that Latin America, in the case of North America separated as a unit and kind of came up with an agreement to keep the colonies together. In the case of South America, given the fact that the distances were so much larger, in North America, you know, the distance probably from one end of the colony, of the English colonies, from one end to the most extreme end must have been maybe 400 miles. In the case of Latin America, you're talking about thousands and thousands of miles, and much of it through incredibly, you know, adverse type of terrain, you know, jungles, very thick jungles, or very, very dense mountains, or incredibly, you know, dry deserts. And so the intercommunication was very, very difficult. And so as a result, you know, the boundaries were not very well defined. And some of this stuff, some of these commodities end up being found in these kind of gray areas. In fact, when the independence movement started happening, and I saw this in the case of Argentina, when they were looking at the maps, they were trying to identify which territories belong to which parish. And in fact, that's how they start to do the division. Because, like, for example, Argentina was part of the viceroyalty of Peru. Now that creates all sorts of problems. And as in the late 1700s, as more and more contraband is going up the River Plate and going up to the Paraná, then there's a change in monarchy in Spain. They decide to just claw away Argentina, make it its own viceroyalty. That way you have royal control in Buenos Aires and get rid of all the contrabandists and at least make the contrabandists official government agents. But then they were trying to figure out, okay, where do we draw the line? Okay, sometimes it's easy to do because it's, you know, you have rivers and stuff like that. Other times it was just on the basis of parishes. Okay, which parish is which is where? And then you have, you know, territories such as Bolivia, what we call Bolivia, which in the colonial days were called Alto Peru. It switches back and forth between belonging to Peru, the viceroyalty of Peru, or belonging to the viceroyalty of Rio de la Plata, which today is what we call Argentina. And so it was very much no man lands. These were very underpopulated type of areas, large indigenous populations. But then when they all of a sudden become important because they hold deposits of, again, nitrates or rubber or oil or stuff like that, and then you have commercial interests, especially coming in out of Europe, but also coming out of the United States, that they then go in and begin to buy off politicians, influence governments, and basically go to war.
I found it really interesting that some countries in South America were basically created simply to be buffer states between the larger, more powerful ones next door. I was wondering if you could outline how that came about, that process of creating buffer states, and whether it hampered the viability of those countries going forward from there.
You know, one of the things that, as a Latin American student, that I've always been intrigued by is the Latin American map, because it kind of doesn't make any sense. You know, when you look at the Latin American map, it's this hodgepodge of countries. Some of them have access to coastlines, you know, some of them don't, some of them are in really hostile type of territory. It isn't really based on tribes or is it based on even on countries of colonization. It just is, it's a very strange map with, you know, sometimes it's natural boundaries, sometimes there's even no natural boundaries that are there. And as I started to read Latin American history, I realized that, again, Latin America and the United States both are born out of the Industrial Revolution. So we're talking about, you know, early 1800s. And one of the big diplomatic innovations of, if you want to call it, the Napoleonic Age, was the creation of the buffer state. When, you know, when Napoleon then expands out and he starts moving into these other countries, at the end, what the diplomatic core decided to do was kind of create these buffer states, these spaces of population that would separate, you know, countries. So, for example, that's how you start getting Luxembourg, you start getting Belgium. I know I'm going to annoy some people when I say this, but probably how you start getting Switzerland, and you start creating these countries that are going to separate the big powers of Europe. And France is definitely one of the big powers. England is separated by the English Channel. But it was clear that at some point in time, Germany was going to coalesce into a major state. You still have, Italy didn't exist, but you knew that that was going to coalesce at one point in time. They also had their own natural buffer, which is the Alps. Well, as I mentioned before, the big kind of natural powers, or the legacies, political legacies that you had of Latin America, was the viceroyalties. And there were four major viceroyalties in Latin America. One of them was Peru, okay, where it had enormous amount of resources all around Lima. And there you had forts, you had population, you had infrastructure, okay? The second one is Nueva Granada, which is to what today is Ecuador, Colombia, and Venezuela. The third one is Rio de la Plata, which is Argentina, which didn't have a lot of natural resources that they cared about at that moment in time. Okay, later on they would in the form of agriculture, but that wasn't a major export in the early 1800s. And then the fourth one for the Spanish crown, it was Mexico. And then the fifth one, which is the Portuguese one, which is Brazil. And the thing is that in the early days of independence, as you're getting Bolivar and the different generals, you start seeing that there's rivalries, you know, between these viceroyalties. They call them new names, but there is enormous amounts of rivalries, and there's differences that have developed just by the way the colonizations have been, you know, organized. You know, like for example, Colombia, which is kind of the heart of Nueva Granada. There, the capital is Bogota. It's a very conservative society because it's so far remote. I mean, it would take months to go from the coast walking up the mountains to get up to Bogota. So you had a very, very conservative, layered type of society, very legalistic type of society. On the other hand, you had viceroyalties in cities like, you know, Buenos Aires, you know, in Rio de la Plata, which was very cosmopolitan because it's a port. You know, they call it the entreport. So you had all sorts of Europeans, French, British, Scots, all sorts of stuff. So they have a completely different mindset as far as trade goes, as far as relations with the rest of the world. You have then the Peruvian part, which you have the big indigenous population. So there is a very caste-driven society of, you know, Europeans or people of European birth, you know, controlling all the levers of power and making sure that they keep the indigenous populations under control. And this creates rivalry between them. And so as a result, there starts to develop conflicts, border conflicts. And again, the borders between these new countries were not very well defined. And the first one who takes advantage of this is Britain, because Britain saw that there was an enormous amount of trade opportunities, especially in the Rio de la Plata region. They saw that there was opportunities for the export of cotton, for the export of leather, all sorts of beef was starting to become a thing, and they wanted access to the River Plate. Now, the problem is that if Uruguay is part of Argentina, okay, then the River Plate is a national river. Okay, you can't just barge into a national river. But if Uruguay is carved away as an independent state, and if you take a look at the map of Uruguay, and I urge you to do it, you'll see it's virtually an island. It's surrounded by water on three parts. It's surrounded by the Atlantic on the eastern part. It's you have the River Plate on the southern part, and you have the Uruguay River on the western part. If Uruguay then becomes an independent country, then the waterway, the River Plate waterway, becomes an international waterway. and all of a sudden countries have got access into that. And so there was this big, you know, to-do. There would have been a conflict already between Argentina and Brazil, which I cover in the first chapter called the Platine and Cisplatine conflict. Reason why it's called Platine is because Argentina was back then called Rio de la Plata, and so Plata becomes Platine, and Cisplatine, it means crossing. Cis in Latin means crossing, so crossing the river plate. So there have been these conflicts where the imperial forces of the Portuguese crown had interceded in some of the civil wars, the powers for the struggles that were taking place inside in Argentina to try to get control or have a bigger dominance as to what was going on there. The British then intercede and say, okay, really what we need to do is have a buffer state between you two countries because the two of you are always going to be at each other's throats. And so what we propose is that Uruguay doesn't belong to either one of you. It becomes just a neutral state, and then we're going to put that. But also in the process, then because of the waterways that surround Uruguay, then the river plate also all of a sudden becomes an international waterway, given full navigation access to any country that wants to use it. And just like that, we started seeing that then repeated with Paraguay, again, keeping Brazil and Argentina away from each other. There was the War of the Triple Alliance, which is this devastating war for Paraguay, where we saw it lose 40% of its population, about 60%, 40% of its territory, about 60% of its population, just destroyed what at that time was one of the more advanced countries in Latin America. And at one point in time, the Brazilians proposed, after the war, they proposed to the Argentine government, how about we just make it go away? We just disappear it. And we just, you know, divide the territory between the two of us. And Argentina said, no, we'd rather not, because we'd rather have as little contact with you, Brazil, as possible, because we just have natural rivalries between the two of us, and we would rather have the separation of distance. And in the end, the same thing happens with Bolivia, which in the colonial days was called Alto Peru. Again, it was a territory that at one point in time had been owned by the Peruvian Viceroyalty. At another time, it had been owned by the Rio Plata Viceroyalty. Those were two, again, very powerful viceroyalties in Latin America, Peru and Buenos Aires. And in fact, the initial part of the War of Independence for Argentina is fought in Alto Peru. Those were some of the early skirmishes because of Potosí, of the huge, you know, silver that existed there. And so whoever owned Potosí would be the kingmaker of South America. And so the final solution there, and it's, I'm simplifying a lot over there, is the creation of an independent country called Bolivia, which really pissed off Simón Bolívar to no end when he heard about this. He didn't really want this at all. But then kind of when you saw the geopolitics of it and everything, he said, oh, okay, I'll go along with it. Plus, they wined and dined him and made sure that he had a very good time by the time he got to La Paz to try to sort things out. And the last one is Ecuador. And again, Nueva Granada, huge viceroyalty, a lot of power. You have Peru, another very powerful viceroyalty, you know, rivals, natural rivals between them. Why not just kind of keep them separate by creating Ecuador and creating a buffer state between them?
I know that you travel a lot in Latin America for work, and you obviously speak to a lot of people in a lot of different countries over there. So I was wondering if, besides those borders as they exist today on the map, do you think that these conflicts have had a strong legacy on the countries of South America? Do you think that they've had strong effects on the political aims of each country and also on the mindsets of the individuals?
It's had a huge, huge, huge impact. It is very much deep into the cultural, you know, fabric. It is, I would say, it goes into the DNA. These conflicts really mark how the countries see each other, and I think it's been very much to the detriment of the region. Because from when you look from outside of Latin America, you see a very homogeneous region. You see a region that was colonized by basically the same colonizing power, speaks the same language with the exception of Brazil, is very heavily Catholic. You're like, wow, you know, this is a region that is just as networked together as it possibly could be, until you go into those countries. And, you know, they just, they see themselves fully as who they are, as their own nationality, and everybody else is almost like an enemy. The amount of just deep-seated hatred, and I can just use the word hatred, that Bolivia and Peru has towards Chileans, and the denigration that Chileans feel towards Peruvians and Bolivians just cannot be explained. You see it at every single, you know, level. You see it in government spending. You know, Chile spends probably the most or the second most of any Latin American country on defense as its percentage of GDP, because it feels so threatened. Argentines have gone to, have almost gone to war as, you know, recently as the 1980s, late 1970s against Chile. And so Chile feels like it is completely surrounded by enemies. And so therefore it has cutting edge, and say again, cutting edge technology when it comes to armament. It has F-18 airplanes. It buys the most latest submarines from Germany. And, you know, most of its naval ships are made in England. It spends enormously on defense. The same thing goes with Peru. Peru, you know, but gets most of its equipment from Russia, or has gotten a lot of its equipment from Russia, but also, you know, spends enormous amounts of defense. The rivalry that you see between Argentina and Brazil is not limited to the football pitch. You know, there is this deep-seated hatred between the two countries, even though, you know, Brazilians love to vacation in Buenos Aires, and Argentines love to go to the beaches of Búzios and Rio de Janeiro, there is enormous amounts of animosities. The animosity that, you know, Colombians feel towards Venezuelans and Ecuadorians cannot be understated. And so this is a lot of it, the legacy. And the reason why I started to focus on these wars, you know, like you said, I traveled a lot throughout the region, is because I would arrive in these airports and I would be on my way to my hotel and I would see these monuments, and they were military monuments. I had no idea what they were referring to. And I started then, you know, kind of looking into, I had never heard of the War of the Triple Alliance, or I had never heard of the War of the Pacific. I had never heard about, you know, the Rubber Wars. And then when I started then asking people in meetings and stuff like that, I saw the passion that they have. And Chileans, especially Chileans, Chileans are incredibly proud people. And they're incredibly proud of their military triumphs that they've had in the War of the Pacific, in the War of the Confederation, even though, you know, some horrible things happened. But if you read the book and you take a look at the book, they're fascinating wars. They're wars that took place in the most hostile type of environments, in snow-covered passes. It took place in the middle of deserts. Deserts where there was no form of navigation, where armies would march around in circles, where at one point in time the Bolivian army ran out of water and then they started drinking their supply of liquor because they would feed their soldiers, you know, shots of liquor before battle. But then the army got completely drunk and then started basically dying off of dehydration in the middle of the Atacama Desert. I mean, these are incredibly, you know, interesting type of conflicts. River battles on the Paraná River between, you know, the Paraguayan and the Brazilian navies. It is really interesting. And then when you ask, because the interesting thing about the Latin American is that he knows or she knows enormous amounts of history of their own country, but they don't know very much about the history about the other country. So, you know, a Peruvian, sure, will know all sorts of the stories of the war with Chile. And the siege of Lima. And in fact, they have national dishes that you can go to any Peruvian restaurant, and you'll see that. For example, if you go to a Peruvian restaurant, you'll see a dish called causa, It's called La Causa, which means the cause. I was in Switzerland a couple of months ago, and I saw it on the menu in Geneva. And I was asking with a bunch of people. I said, "Do you know where that comes from?" Because it's a it's a plate made of basic food, breadcrumbs and stuff. And that's they go, "No." I go, "Well, that's when Lima was being sieged and they had ran out of food, and that was the only dish that could be made. It was made out of, you know, stale breadcrumbs and this kind of like stew type of a thing." So it's very much embedded deep into the psychology. So the Peruvians are going to know enormous amounts of their own history. But you ask them, what about the War of the Triple Alliance? You know, where Argentina, Uruguay, and Brazil ganged up on Paraguay. They don't know anything about it. They don't even know it existed. So that was another motivation for my book. But the good thing was that I had the benefit of traveling to all of these countries and meeting and seeing these people. And as a result, they pointed me to historians. I mean, the Argentines are very proud of their own conflicts. And like the last conflict I have there is the Falklands War, the Malvinas, as they're called in Argentina. And hearing it from the Argentine perspective, because, you know, from the European perspective, from the British perspective, it's like we came, we saw, we conquered, you know, we kicked their butt. But when you look at it at you know, how close, in the book I say basically by a puff of wind, you know, the British were able to win, or they almost lost the war. It's really incredible how this basically ragtag air force of Argentine pilots flying airplanes which are 30 years old were able to inflict the biggest naval loss on Britain that it had since World War I. And so it really is quite interesting and fascinating. And again, being able to talk to, you know, in some cases veterans or on historians or people that are just motivated. I've been in many lunches in the most prestigious banks in Santiago and listened to guys who are basically armchair historians and have been given books upon books about, you know, about these conflicts, about the Chilean conflicts. Chile had a couple of conflicts. The most notable one was the War of the Pacific.
Yeah, I have to say that was very interesting for me, being British, reading about the Malvinas, the Falklands, because it was before my time. But you just don't hear about, you don't hear much about the war itself. It's all about how Britain, either how Britain was great and stood up for itself, or the alternative narrative is that it was Thatcher trying to, distract people from all the damage she was doing. But both narratives just. The Argentinian side is kind of considered like a prop. No one really considers that they may have actually come out on top. So I found that personally very, very interesting to read. My last question is about kind of about the future. Obviously, Bolivar's dream was to unite Spanish America, and in light of all these conflicts, that's not going to happen. However, there are quite a lot of organisations which unite the states, like Mercosur. I think ALBA's another one for the more socialist countries. So I was just wondering, do you see closer union between the Latin American countries as realistic? And if so, do you think it's the way to go? Do you think it could be good for the region as a whole in the future?
Well, I thank you for the question, because I think that is a huge, important question. I had three objectives when I wrote this book. One of them was to kind of have one central telling of the Latin American conflicts, which I haven't seen that. Okay, that one, in researching for this book, and I spent a lot of time researching. I went up to Yale Library and their whole network of libraries and really spent a lot of time. And there's enormous amount of research on each individual war, even the wars of the Confederation, the Cisplatine, Platine Wars, you know, obviously in some of them more in Spanish or Portuguese than there is in English. The War of the Triple Alliance, there's a good amount of work on that. The Chaco War, you know, that's given the fact that was already in the 1900s. There's a lot of research on that. So one of them was to provide a central location where you could see all the major conflicts that affected the region. The second objective of the book was to kind of try to explain the Latin American map. Why does it look like that? You know, why do you have, you know, a couple of large countries surrounded by a bunch of really small countries, and countries that again, don't make much sense because they don't have access to the ocean. They're kind of like there in the middle of nowhere. And yet they kind of create these like little belts around countries as well. Why does it exist? And then the third objective was, what is the future of Latin America? And here I'm more on shaky ground, okay, or on thin ice. Because as you said, the thing is that most of the attempts to kind of bring Latin America together have really been done for political reasons, okay? Bolivar tried to do it initially, and he found that, again, the distances in the distances and also the terrain that needed to be crossed, the communication that was there, just didn't really lend for integration of these colonies. And, you know, again, one of the problems with the original organization that it was done by the Spanish was that all of the communication with Europe was done through sea. There was very little, land type of communication. And even if you take a look at countries with very long borders, like Argentina and Chile, the official number of crossings is limited. And for those of you that, you know, want to do an interesting trip, I, you know, really strongly encourage to do a trip where you cross back and forth between Chile and Argentina. There's some fantastic crossings, and not just between, you know, the northern parts, you know, that connect Mendoza with Santiago, though it's kind of the most famous ones, but down in Patagonia, there's some fantastic crossings where you go by, you know, volcanoes and just beautiful geography. And so the thing is that, this objective to kind of bring the region together didn't really work out for Bolivar. He found that there were also, you know, big differences in culture. Then it's, you know, resurrected a couple of times again, most recently by Chavez to try to create a more socialist type of union, which, of course, was dead on arrival, especially in regards to the United States, which is ALBA. Mercosur was more of a, it really was born out of communication between the auto industries in Argentina and Brazil, and to provide, you know, greater economies of scale to create a customs union between the two countries, which, by the way, that's how NAFTA, or the North American Free Trade Agreement, is born. It's born out of the automobile industry. It's born out of the automobile industry in the United States that wants to take advantage of the auto production that they have in Canada and the ability to expand auto production into Mexico. And so what they want to do is they lobby Washington heavily to have just one unified trade treaty that they can then apply the same rules for their trade with Canada and their trade with Mexico. And that's what Mercosur is. They also then bring in Paraguay and Uruguay, but it was kind of more like afterthoughts to give it kind of more of a regional type of flavor. But it was really, you know, what something in operation called Auto Latina, which was the big driver for the creation of Mercosur, and so therefore it doesn't really expand out any further. Under the Kirchners, they try to bring in Venezuela, who then comes in as an observer, but then it starts getting more politicized. But the thing is that I think that the future of Latin America as a viable part of the global economy has to become as some kind of unification. And it's the lesson that we got out of Europe, which is kind of not the current lesson, but the reason why the European Union came together is because the European countries, while they're wealthy in their own stead, okay, meaning, you know, you have countries like Holland and you have countries like Luxembourg, which on a per capita basis are very wealthy, when you put them against behemoths, when you put them against monsters such as China, such as the United States, just don't register. Okay, you can't, you know, when two countries sit down and negotiate trade, it's basically, you know, how many widgets am I going to buy from you and how much widgets are you going to buy from me? Okay, so when the Chinese and the Americans sit down and they talk about trade, it's like, how many hundreds of billions of dollars in, you know, auto equipment are you going to buy from me? How many hundreds of billions of dollars in computers are you going to buy from me? And then you're kind of talking among equals, and then you can have some give and take, and there's room for negotiation. When a monster like the United States sits down and talks to, you know, Belgium or even England, and that's what Obama told, you know, told London when they were talking about Brexit. President Obama said, if you leave out of the European Union, you are not going to be as relevant to us because you no longer have the scale and scope. So what Europe decided to do was to come together as a trade bloc, you know, also with other types of aims. You know, there's more economic integration, there was more immigration, all this kind of stuff. They come together and therefore become a meaningful negotiating bloc against these major powers, i.e. the rising, you know, global powers, because it was clear what was happening was that the United States was this huge, you know, economic powerhouse, and China was going to be the next economic powerhouse. And if Europe wanted to become, wanted to remain relevant within that kind of condition or environment, it needed to come together, because now it could sit there and say to the Americans, hey, by the way, I've got, you know, 350 million population. I've got a GDP of $16 trillion. Okay, let's talk. Okay, let's talk. And now the Americans would listen. It wouldn't be like pushing around, you know, the Italians or pushing around the Spanish or anything like that. And it worked. And I think that's why the European Union is going to survive, even though there's a lot of rivalries between members of the Union and there's a lot of political issues involved. It has to survive for economic purposes. That's the thing with Latin America. Latin America, and I got into this, into a huge conflict and fight with the Spanish economist in Spain a couple of years ago. And the thing is that Latin America, as I mentioned before, its area of comparative advantage is commodities. It has a lot of commodities, it has a lot of natural resources for the size of population that it has. Latin American populations are relatively small, very concentrated in a few cities, but they're very small. Like I've mentioned before, Argentina is half the size of the continental United States with only 15% of the population. So you have enormous amounts of wheat that's left over, beef that's left over, oil that's left over, all this kind of stuff that you don't need it, and so therefore you can export it to the rest of the world. Now the thing is that the rest of the world wants to buy Latin American commodities unprocessed. They want to buy the raw commodities. They don't want to buy the processed commodities because the processed commodity is where the money is. And you've probably seen the newspaper articles where they'll show a glass, you know, a cup of Starbucks coffee, and they'll have, you know, one out of $1 or 100% of the price of a Starbucks coffee, you know, what goes to where, you know, and they'll have, you know, marketing gets 20%, and the owner of the retail gets another 25%, and then you get down to the coffee bean grower, and he gets like 3%. All of the value added is when the processing starts. You know, when you, for example, soybeans, and this is where I got into the argument with this Spanish economist. You know, soybeans, unprocessed soybeans into China go in with zero tariff. The Chinese will buy Argentine soybeans or Brazilian soybeans free of tariff all day long. But when you process it, and processing soybeans, all you do is you dry the soybean and you mill it. What I mean by mill it is you put it between two stones and you grind it into a powder. That then has a 30% tariff on it. Now, you're going to say, what is the difference? The difference in price between milled soybeans and raw soybeans is multiple times. Okay, there's a huge markup between the processed and the unprocessed. And you can go down the list. You can see, for example, coffee. Unprocessed coffee. Most of the coffee that comes out of South America is unprocessed. All the process is toasting the coffee. All you do is you put it into a drum and you put a fire underneath it and you roll the drum and you toast the coffee. That's why when you go into so many different ports, especially in the United States, because I know it very well, what you're going to see is the old plants that are left over. You know, Domino Sugar, you'll see Maxwell Coffee, and they kind of adorn the waterfront. But that's where the factories were, where they processed the commodities that they got from Latin America. If you go, for example, to the Caribbean islands, you're going to see there's a bunch of refineries all throughout the Caribbean. You know, St. Martin has got refineries. Cayman's got, I think Cayman, but there's refineries located all throughout the Caribbean basin. The Caribbean basin doesn't produce any oil. All the oil came out of Venezuela. But none of the major oil companies wanted to put their refineries inside of Venezuela because they were afraid that they would then be nationalized. So therefore, they put them on islands which were under their national control. So St. Martin's was under, half of it was under Dutch control, or the Netherlands control. Shell was a Dutch company. So therefore, the raw oil that they bought from Venezuela, they then process it in St. Martin. And the thing is that when it came time to do the negotiation, and so let me get to the argument. So what this economist says is, he said, well, you know, maybe it's just that the Latin Americans don't have the technology to process their commodities. And I'm like, how much technology do you need to toast coffee or to grind sugar or to mill soybeans? I mean, it is the most basic technology in the world. The difference is that there's a lot more value added. And so the developed world, the West, wanted to keep the value added for themselves. I mean, it makes sense. You know, you can pay workers more money. You know, you can employ a bigger part of the population, et cetera, et cetera. The reason why Latin America has to take that, and I'll give you another example. Sorry. I was in Switzerland once, checking out of the Swiss hotel in Zurich. And the girl at the reception very graciously says to me, are you going home? I said, yep, I'm on the next flight. She goes, okay, well, she goes, make sure you take, you know, a box of our Swiss chocolate because we make the best chocolate in the world. I said, do you really? You go, yes, we do. I go, by the way, where do you get your cocoa from? Can you show me where the cocoa plants are? And they were like, huh? What are you talking about, cocoa? It's that way, you know. But have you ever heard of Latin American chocolate? Actually, if you go to Ecuador and you go to Venezuela, there's some very good brands of domestically made chocolate, but they don't really sell outside of the regions or outside of the airport, really. And so the only way Latin America can get any kind of meaningful, you know, reaction from these major, you know, powers, i.e. Europe, the European Union, the United States, and the Chinese, is if they come together like the European Union did and negotiate in bloc, saying, look, you know, you want our soybeans? Great. You know, we're going to sell you processed soybeans. But now, given the fact that when we unify ourselves, okay, when we come together as a single bloc, now we're talking about populations that rival the United States, that rival Europe, that are almost the same type of GDP. GDP doesn't get to 16, 17 trillion, but you're talking about GDPs that are talking about $10 trillion. You're talking about imports of cars that are in the millions, not in the thousands, like when Argentina sits or Colombia sits to negotiate cars. And then you can get a different kind of situation. And I think this is something that the West or that the rest of the world is scared of. And so therefore, they will happily keep Latin America divided as much as possible. In fact, I had read once a long time ago that one of the, you know, nightmare scenarios for the U.S. military is the possible integration of Africa into a cohesive economic bloc for that same reason, because all of a sudden, their negotiating clout changes completely. It's one thing pushing around the Congo. It's another issue pushing around, I don't know what it is, 27 different countries with a population in the billions. And so I think that this is what is eventually going to happen. Unfortunately, the politics gets in the way. The rivalries get in the way. The legacies of, yes, I still remember, you know, my great-grandfather fought in the War of the Pacific. Or my great-grand, you know, we had land. And I've heard this because I've heard it from friends of mine. My family had territories that were in Peru, but today we've lost them because they're in Chile. Or, you know, I all sorts of stories like that. And they're very much kept alive. And until Latin America learns to overcome them, then it's not going to get the economic benefits that's going to come with economic integration.
Well, that's fascinating. Thanks. Thanks again for coming on the podcast. The book's called When Latins Fight, Why There's No United States of South America. And am I right in saying you can find it on Amazon?
Yes, you can. You can find it in written form, a hard book in Spanish and in English. Or you can get it on Kindle, which is available in Portuguese, English, and Spanish as well.
Excellent. Thanks again.
Thank you, Max. It's been fun.
You've been listening to the Latin American History Podcast. Written and recorded by Max Sargent. For more information, visit the website www.maxsergeant.com/thehistoryoflatinamerica. And that's spelt MaxSergeant. If you have any comments or questions, feel free to get in contact at historyoflatinamericapodcast@gmail.com. You can also find the Facebook page by searching for the Latin American History Podcast. The Twitter handle is @HistoryLatinAM. And if you've liked the show, you can help out by leaving a review on iTunes. Alternatively, if you visit the website, you'll see that each episode is accompanied by relevant photos. Most of these are my own, taken during my time in Latin America. All these photos and more are available to purchase as prints at my Etsy shop. You can find this at www.etsy.com/maxsergeantphoto. That's spelt www.etsy.com/maxsergeant photo. Thanks for listening.
Waiting on a tax return? Hopefully it ends up in your hands. Fraudulent tax returns due to identity theft increased by 30% in 2023. If you're in a bind this tax season, LifeLock can help. Our U.S.-based restoration specialists are experts dedicated to helping solve your identity theft issues. And all LifeLock plans are backed by the $1 Million Protection Package. So we'll reimburse you up to the limits of your plan if you lose money due to identity theft. Help protect your information this tax season with LifeLock. Save up to 25% your first year at LifeLock.com/aware.